Welcome back, everybody. Class 7, we've been doing a survey through the tantric universe, slowly circling in closer and closer and getting into more and more detail for this unit, Introduction to Tantra. So what we've already covered so far, right on the outskirts of the circle coming inwards, the six names of Tantra, the uniqueness of Tantra, what makes it so special, so rare, such an amazing quick path, how the foundation of the three principal aspects of the path is what makes Tantra Buddhist, because there's all different types of Tantra. So Buddhist Tantra is based on this sutra vehicle, the three principal aspects, renunciation, bodhicitta, and correct view. We've looked at the qualities of a student and a Vajra master. What do we have to do from our side, and how to be able to tell who is a valid Vajra master? Because once we devote and once we have an initiation, then there's no going back. Then it's too late for regret. So you have to investigate first. We looked at the four classes of Tantra, from mostly the lower Tantras and then High Surga Tantra, and how they are distinguished in terms of how much blissful energy you can take onto the path without going crazy, without succumbing to the allure of samsaric pleasure. We've also looked at the substantial causes for Dharmakaya and Rupakaya, and how it's only within the tantric path that we have the substantial causes for both, both the mind of a Buddha and the body of a Buddha. And because these two are one, they have to be attained simultaneously. And then last week we looked at path of action Tantra, the lower Tantras, with two divisions. Does anyone remember what those two divisions are in the path of action Tantra? Ben, go for it. Just give us one.
Yoga with signs.
Yoga with signs. Bing. And what's the other one?
Yoga without.
Yoga without signs. And now, what do they mean? Ben, what's yoga with signs? What's the main thing? The conventional dependent arising of what?
Deity.
The deity. Yep. And Chris, what's the main thing about yoga without signs? Yeah, so what is the main practice of it? So the main focus, that is the emptiness. So the appearing of the deity while empty. So the main part of that is the empty aspect. And so both of those happen simultaneously, appearing while empty. And remember the analogy was like a white snow mountain. The snow mountain through blue glasses. So it appears blue, but you know it's white. So one is from the side of appearance and the other is from the side of ascertainment. And that it happens simultaneously. And then we also went into a little bit of detail about what's called self-generation by means of the six deities. And this was how, in a very detailed visualization of, say, the deity Chenrezig, how step by step, meditating on emptiness and the Dharmakaya and then the Sambhogakaya and then the Nimanakaya, through all of these stages, a little bit like when you've got a microscope and you can go into one level of focus and then a deeper level and a deeper level. So all levels exist simultaneously. It just depends what we've been focusing on. So I found another slightly kitsch and memorable thing to help you remember this: signed, sealed, and delivered. So signed yoga with signs, sealed with emptiness, and delivered. Do you get it? Action Tantra, signed, sealed, and delivered. Enlightenment.
Oh.
What's delivered? Deliverance, enlightenment, that's right.
Sorry,
I didn't get the punchline. Yeah, I know. I'm a bit weak on the punchline side of things.
Very strong on the kitsch
It's going to be memorable. I mean, you know, our unconscious has a very, you know, risque and slightly, you know, base sense of humour. So what we're going to have a look at then today now is the other end of the spectrum, the path of highest yoga tantra. And that is all about how exactly do we transform ourselves into a Buddha in just one lifetime. So the lower tantras, it's a little bit like learning about nuclear power in general. Highest yoga tantra is like getting the plans to the entire nuclear power station and operating that power station. So it's a big difference between just learning in general and then actually using that power station. Hopefully, as we go through, I'll be able to clear up a few misconceptions that have arisen from popular culture and that can lead us into trouble. We're also going to have what I call a psychic anatomy lesson. And so this outlines the coarse and then subtle levels of body and mind, otherwise known as chakras, channels, winds, and drops. So you might have heard one of those words, chakras. So this is the chakras from the Buddhist point of view. And while in action tantra, you have yoga with signs and yoga without signs. In highest yoga tantra, you have generation stage and completion stage. And what you do is you take death, intermediate state, and rebirth onto the path. So this is something that we all go through. So it's taking this universal experience onto the path to transform ourselves into a Buddha. So it's very subtle, it's very profound, it's quite complex, it's really precision mapping. There's no experimentation here, just like with a nuclear power station. You don't want to just go, oh, what about if we just did this and change this bit while we're at it? So I have a quote from Dzongsa Khyentse Rinpoche, and he says, "The Vajrayana is the best thing that ever happened on this planet. Not only does it train us to think outside samsara's box, it shows us how to be inside and outside the box at the same time." Which I just think is such a wonderful, wonderful way to bridge the two worlds of how we have all this tantric description, and then we have our worlds of science and physics and quantum physics, and they do come together parallel really nicely. We're going to start with a meditation, just a short one. A slightly more detailed 9-round breathing that we're, I mean, some of you are used to the 9-round breathing, but this one, becoming aware as we're doing the breathing of those subtle energy channels. You don't have to worry about the colours, it's mainly this, the shape. So the central channel goes from what they say the peak of the nose, which is kind of around here somewhere, and curves around the inside of the skull and down the inside of your body, just in front of your spine. And then the two side ones from the nostrils also curving around a little bit like an umbrella handle, and down either side, also just in front of your spine. And they all join 4 fingers below the navel. So they're like light tubes, light beam tubes. So let's start by just settling our posture, straightening your spine. Once your spine is stable and aligned, then you can relax your shoulders and relax the body because it's well supported. Bring your awareness inwards, simply resting on the focus of the breath. And when we do these 9 rounds of breathing, we're focusing not so much on breathing with our breath, but with our energy. So first imagine that you're breathing in the light of wisdom and kindness itself. And you breathe in through the left nostril, and it flows through this light tube, down through your body. And then as you breathe out through the right nostril, the light pushes up and out through the right channel all the darkness of negativity. And this negativity leaves your body like pollution leaving a chimney. So try and do 3 long, leisurely breaths. And try and follow the light all the way along those light beam tubes. And when you've completed the first 3 rounds, then swap the nostrils over, and this time breathe in the light through the right nostril. It travels up around the inside of your skull, down the light beam tube, swaps over to the other side. And as you breathe out, it pushes out all of your negative energy in the form of smoke through that left channel. And try and keep your focus on the entire journey of this light as it flows through your body. So 3 long, leisurely breaths. And then finally breathe in through both nostrils, the light flowing down both beam tubes on either side. And as you breathe out, the light comes up through the central tube, pushing out all negativities. Again, like toxic smoke leaving a chimney. And it leaves through the peak of the nose, somewhere just below the level of the eyebrows. So 3 long, leisurely breaths. And then just spend a few moments simply breathing radiant, clear light. Feeling that light flowing through those 3 channels without obstruction, and light radiating from these channels, filling your whole body. And now that body and mind are aligned, then we can set our motivation for the class. So bringing to mind the great guru Vajradhara, arising from the deep blue unobstructed space of the Dharmakaya. And so when we take refuge, then we remember that it's a Mahayana refuge. We're doing this for others. And we remember what we're taking refuge in, the Dharmakaya, the Sambhogakaya, the Nimanakaya. So we can recite the prayer. Sangye Choran Sogye Chonam Lai Chanchu Padu Dani Kyapsu Chi Dagi Chenye Kepe Sonam Ki Chala Penche Sangye Chopa Sho Sangye Choran Sogye Chonam Lai Chanchu Padu Dani Kyapsu Chi Tagi chenye kepe sonam ki chola penje sangye drupa sho sangye cheran soke chanam lai chanchu padu dani kapsu chi tagi chenye kepe sonam ki chola penje sangye drupa sho. The Seven-Limb Prayer. Goso go pe go ne cha tse lo na sham ye cho cha tre ma lu bo to me ne sa di to tam che shai ke pa of samsara and nirvana. So I have quite a few readings from Lama Yeshe tonight, and so this is all from Introduction to Tantra, and how the basis of both samsara and nirvana is the same. So taking advantage of our human form, turning the experience of death, bardo and rebirth into the path to enlightenment is not a fantasy. Because we have the type of body that we do, we can definitely accomplish this great aim. According to the sutra teachings, we've been taught our present physical body is viewed largely as a hindrance. It's decaying from moment to moment, prone to sickness, and attracts misery in the way a magnet attracts pieces of iron. In fact, the most succinct way of defining the first noble truth of suffering is to say it is the body itself. But the tantric teachings take the opposite view. Far from being a hindrance or obstacle, the human body is regarded as something most precious because it contains all the necessary equipment for reaching enlightenment in one lifetime. We are fortunate to have this type of body and should not waste the precious opportunity it gives us to realize our full potential. We shouldn't be like those people who don't know how to use their natural resources properly. For example, I know of some Nepalese farmers who cut down mango trees for firewood. It takes so many years for a mango tree to grow and its fruit is so precious, but these people do not seem to appreciate this. Instead of making good use of what they have, they destroy these precious trees, lose their land through erosion, and are left with nothing. If we neglect to use our body's precious energy for the attainment of enlightenment and squander it instead on the meaningless pursuits of this life, then we are far more ignorant than those farmers. Rather, we should be like those ingenious scientists who know how to extract energy from everything, from sunlight, the tides, the winds, and who also know how to put this energy to constructive use. In other words, we should be skillful, and the highest skill involves transforming our present body from a source of pain and dissatisfaction into the blissful path to unsurpassed happiness for ourselves and others. And this is the ultimate goal of all tantric practice. Sums it up beautifully. So the basis of samsara, our body, we're so used to seeing it as it being viewed as a source of all of our problems, and to try and kind of practice as much renunciation as we can. But also our body can be the basis of nirvana. And in fact, it's a perfect vehicle to carry us to enlightenment. And as all the lamas say, whether we go up or down, well, that's our choice. So to kind of extend this analogy, we've got a passport, right? The passport is our three principal aspects of the path. That's our passport to get there. We've got to get a visa before we arrive in any land, in any mandala. We need a visa, and that's the initiation. And then the highest yoga tantra practice, that's like we receive the guidebook when we get there. And don't confuse the contents of that guidebook, which is like all of the charts and scales and this and that and descriptions. That's just like the contents page. The actual guidebook is the sadhana, is the whole practice, is you go here and you do this and you do that. That's the whole rest of the book. So if we're really prepared, we can, instead of have an ordinary death, we can arise into the illusory body. And we can do it in a controlled manner. And so not only is it possible to attain Buddhahood in one lifetime, it can be while we're alive, or it can be during our actual death process. But I mean, this makes this process so incredibly quick. So part of whether we go up or down being our choice is also we've got to keep our vows and samaya, our commitments with the guru. And that's a little bit like abiding by the laws of the land. So you don't want to be like those TV shows that I love so much, like Banged Up Abroad, or my favourite, Young, Dumb and Banged Up in the Sun. Right, so that's people just thinking, oh, lovely land, let's just go and have fun, and they have not a care in the world, and they haven't planned anything, they don't know the rules, they don't know the laws, they've got no respect, and they just think it's going to be great, and they end up in prison. And this show is amazing because it just actually shows how attachment works against us, and how sometimes the very worst things that happen to us, we can actually turn around. So it is actually quite inspiring when we get to the end of the stories. So we don't want to be like that. We want to keep our vows and samayas. Okay, so that said, what we have for highest yoga tantra, we're looking now at three levels of subtlety. Again, they all exist simultaneously. Just like when we look at the elements in a periodic table, we've got the elements, H2O, that's the only one I know. Then you can look into the particles that make them up, what's in, you know, the atom and the neutron and the this and the that, and then you can go right into the subatomic level, the quantum field. So these three levels are like that. So what we've got, first off, the coarse body, and we know a lot about this in our culture, the circuitry system, blood vessels, nerves. We haven't always. I mean, if we were born several hundred years ago, before Da Vinci, before Descartes, before Lura, before all of this, none of this was known. It was just kind of made up. We had dragons and all sorts of things in there. Lettuces instead of joints. You know, the drawing's really funny. So even so, there are still discoveries being made about our coarse body now. So just a decade ago, the scientists discovered another organ that we have in our body that covers 80% of our body, and it's called the interstitial fluid. And people didn't even know it existed, but it's an actual organ in our body. And the reason they couldn't identify it is that it doesn't work when you're dead. So you can't find it in a corpse. You can only see it operating when someone is alive. And so finally the technology came along and they went, holy moly, what is this? It's a new organ. What do we call it? Interstitial fluid. So all the way along, don't think it's kind of a done deal. We are even just on this coarse level making discoveries. Then, of course, we have associated with these what are called our coarse consciousnesses that rely on our senses. So, you know, eye consciousness, ear consciousness, and our mind consciousness relying on our brain. So that's on the coarse level of things. Then we have the subtle body, which is only talked about in Highest Yoga Tantra. And this is made up of channels, chakras, drops, and the winds upon which the mind rides. So we probably only have an inkling that these exist when they get out of whack. So if you suffer trauma, go into a disassociated state, that's when these winds and everything are out of balance and we feel really out of kilter. When they're out of balance, then we become sick. And we'll go into this a little bit more. But then we also have, even more subtle than this, what's called the very subtle body and mind. So this is called the fundamental mind and the wind upon which it rides. And generally in ordinary life, it only becomes manifest at death time because these more coarse levels have to fall away before it becomes manifest. It's a bit like layers of an onion. There's the center of the onion in there, but the outer layers have to fall away before you can become aware of that center. And this very subtle body and mind are what we can think of as the indestructible continuity that goes from life to life. And it's this continuity that becomes enlightened. It's not like our coarse body. Okay, so questions yet? Yes, so sneezing or orgasm can give you a similitude of what's known as like the clear light. So it's like a moment where it's completely non-conceptual. And in a way, it's blissful, but it's just momentary. And it's a very poor similitude. So I know there was in a previous class when I was talking about like the emperor's new clothes, so how in tantric iconography there's often the, and we don't really have any pictures around, but often the imagery of a man and woman in union. And so this is to indicate the most extreme bliss that we can think of. But actually, it's just a poor similitude. And I know all of you are going, oh, yeah, right, Miffy just hasn't had enough good sex in her life. But honestly, when you learn about these channels and chakras, you can see how we just get a very poor glimpse of what's possible.
I'm thinking I'm not
sneezing. Oh, you're not sneezing properly, that's right. But even, it's not even that. It's like, you know, when you're in an initiation. So the first initiation I had was with Lama Yeshe, and I think I was 16. And that just spoiled me for everything else in my life, honestly. It was like sex, drugs, and rock and roll were just a poor substitute for that experience. So that's how come I know, that's how come I can say that, because the power and the blessing of Lama Yeshe. Unfortunately, you know, I was a bit undisciplined, so I went chasing sex, drugs, and rock and roll for many years, and it had to kind of remind myself again and again that this isn't it. What a waste, never mind. So a little bit more from Lama Yeshe. According to Highest Yoga Tantra, our body and mind exist not only on the gross level we're normally familiar with, but also on subtle levels about which most of us are completely unaware. Our ordinary physical form, composed of various material elements, is subject to the inevitable sufferings of sickness, decay, and death. Merely possessing it binds us to the recurring miseries of our ordinary existence. But within the boundaries or atmosphere of this body is another, far more subtle body, the so-called Vajra body, Vajra having the connotation of indestructible. And just as our gross and perishable physical body is pervaded by the ordinary nervous system, this subtle Vajra body is pervaded by thousands of channels through which flow the energy winds and drops that are the source of the bliss so vital to the highest tantric practice. As is true of our essentially pure and blissful mind, this subtle conscious body exists within us right at the present moment. And the job of the tantric practitioner is to discover and make use of it. Once we've made contact with this clear, conscious body of light through meditation, our gross physical body will no longer be a problem for us. Physical limitations are just another symptom of ego grasping, and once we merge with our essentially pure nature, all such restrictions will be overcome. At that point, the attainment of the radiant light body of the deity ceases to be merely a visualized goal and becomes a reality. So, in other words, we have everything that we need in our body-mind complex. We've already got it to become a Buddha. We've got everything we need. This is why human rebirth is so precious. You know, if we were a cow, we had seven stomachs, we wouldn't have everything that we needed. We'd be far too interested in digestion and all that stuff. But we've got everything. It's like the nuclear power plant is built. It's already there and it's perfect. It's exactly what we need. Okay, so now the psychic anatomy lesson. And I love this picture because it shows us all different ways that we can understand this. And we can think of it that just like with chemistry and particles and atoms and all that, we need to have sophisticated equipment to see it. We can't just see atoms with our naked eye. So the sophisticated equipment, as Corey Jackson so often says, is the technology of the mind, of our focus. And so we need a sophisticated meditation to be able to recognize these levels and interpret what they mean. Because even if physically we got a map of what quarks and neutrons and whatever are doing, zipping around, whatever. We couldn't interpret it. We don't know what that means. Well, at least I don't know what that means. I take what they say, okay, fair enough. So we needed not only be able to recognize it, but then interpret it and then use it. So we have these different meditations to help us recognize these this more subtle level of existence. So the names of these, the chakras and the winds and the channels and drops, just a note for those of you that are thinking of going to the Kala Chakra initiation in Bendigo, the definitions in Kala Chakra of what those things are completely different from any other tantric system. So what I'll briefly cover today is like all of the tantric systems except Kala Chakra. So they just have a different terminology. It's a little bit like describing the nervous system and the circulatory system of the blood. Like they both circulate, but what's happening is really quite different. They both exist simultaneously. One's not right and one's not wrong. But the meanings of these terms are really quite different because they're different systems. Okay, so what we've got first off, the channels. 72,000 branches in the body. And you can see over on the right-hand side, there's more like a schematic diagram, how there's one that comes out and then that divides into two and then that divides into two and so on and so on. Sometimes many times and sometimes just a few times. So this psychic nervous system of the channels runs parallel to our physical nervous system. The energy runs along these channels. And in meditation, when we direct the winds into the central channel, all of the distractions and the sensory consciousnesses also absorb, so we're no longer distracted anymore. They also absorb and conceptualization stops. So generally, while we're alive, our central channel's blocked. So these chakras or energy wheels are actually, for an ordinary being, they're knots. They're knotted, so they block our central channel. They're energy knots. They're kind of energy centers where all the energy twists around. And of course, there are many different ways to differentiate, but mostly in Tibetan Buddhism, there are five main chakras because they're the ones that is worth working with. And what's also interesting is sometimes the descriptions are really different. Sometimes they are talked about as like petals, like the eight-petaled lotus at your heart. So it's not that there's a lotus flower at your heart, but what it symbolizes is far more evocative than, say, the stick diagram on the right-hand side. So some of the practices will describe what is there at present, like the knot, and others will describe the transformation, the loosening of that knot. So some diagrams depict the function of it but not the appearance. Others have the symbolic appearance but not the function, and that's why there's this vast array of descriptions. So it's not that one's right or one's wrong, or that we're all, you know, born differently or whatever. It just depends on what's the purpose of that description. And so then there are the winds, the energy, vital life force. You can think of it as chi or prana, all of these words that we're fairly familiar with. I think personally that, you know, Tai Chi and acupuncture all work with this level. Those meridians, they're energy meridians. And so they're working with that energy that flows through the channels. So we've got the coarse wind that flows through our body, we're breathing. That's the physical wind. Can't exist without it. We also have the subtle winds that flow through our body. And in the lower tantra practices, you kind of bring those winds to the central, to your heart with those meditations. It just naturally happens. So what happens is all the more coarse distractions just fall away. The coarse conceptions fall away. But in the highest yoga tantra, it's far more precise. So you bring the winds into the central channel and you dissolve those knots. And so to be able to do that, it's highly technical work. So here is from the English Geshe Tashi Sering. We can do a practice called cleansing the channels. So that's what we did tonight. You know, we're all familiar with some version of the nine round breathing. So that helps to activate the central channel and protect our mind from possible harm during the practice. So how it protects our mind is it balances our emotions, because often when we're meditating, if our subtle channels are out of whack, it means it's really easy for attachment or anger to just arise out of nowhere. You think it's out of nowhere, but it's because those channels are all out of whack. So doing the cleansing of the channels protects our mind in our practice, because it's protecting our subtle nervous system. So this practice, the cleansing the channels, starts with the nine round breathing meditation. But here we actually, in Highest Yoga Tantra, manipulate the winds, making it a very powerful practice. So instead of imagining, then it's actually happening. You're actually cleansing the channels. We visualize the three main channels with the left and right, entering the central channel, four finger widths below the navel, rather than where they actually do. So again, it's done in visualization. We're doing according to the result that we want. And as we do the nine round breathing, we actually feel each channel being cleansed. And if we're doing completion stage meditation, this is no longer imagination. We're actually doing this. Although cleansing the channels is not a difficult practice, I must give a big warning here that applies to this practice and all the practices that follow it. If you try to do this without proper preparation, which means a thorough grounding in the graduated path, and without a stable deity practice, you will lose your mind. I mean that quite literally. You really need to know what you are doing. Otherwise, all sorts of things can start to happen. If the energies move into a wrong area, moving them back again is incredibly difficult. There are many meditators who've gone completely crazy because they've not followed the practices correctly, or they've tried to take shortcuts. So this is really important, because we are working with subtle energies, and it works. Whether you understand how it works or not, you've got to be careful. So I remember one story when one of the lamas was saying about someone who thought they'd just kind of make a pretty picture and have the channels go out like this to their shoulders and back in again. And so that's how they meditated. And so they actually moved the energy out there. And then everything started going wrong in their life, total distraction, unable to finish anything, really up and down emotions. And so then trying to get the energy back, the Lama basically said, you can't do it. It's too late with this body. You've buggered it up, basically. And having known a lot of people that have taken LSD and other kind of drugs in my youth, and seeing how it kind of blew up their physical nervous system, then I could also see how it blew up their subtle nervous system. And for that, then it's finished for this life. You've blown the carburetor. So it is, you can get quite excited because you think, hey, this is really working. So you want to make sure that you follow the instructions because you want to become a Buddha. Don't kind of forget that. And so then the last one, then you have the drops. So these are really interesting. These drops, they are caused apparently by the coalescing of mind and its accompanying wind or energy in certain areas of the body. These drops permeate our body. On the grosser levels, they're things like bile and phlegm, but on the subtle levels, they're these drops. And they all originate from the red and white drop from the father and mother. And the main one that we hear about is the indestructible drop at the heart. And that's the subtle basis for our whole physical body. Yes, Tom. Coming into being or appearing, manifesting. Coming together and manifesting, coalescing.
So, yeah.
So the graphics, you've got the central channel and the side channels. On the far right of that slide, you've got the schematic diagram of how many channels come out at each of those chakras. So some are very, very busy and some are much smaller. Then you've got where they're situated in the body there. And on the left-hand side, you've got the practice description, which is them as lotuses, lotus with how many petals. And then they've also got seed syllables on them and things. So I'm not sure this is like a generic diagram, but it's going to be more specific according to what practice you do. But it kind of gives you the idea, instead of like when you have a circulatory system map, or an acupuncture system with all the dots map, it's similar to that. Yes, Stefan.
Since five chakras.
Yeah, so this diagram's only got four. Usually it's five. So secret place, navel, heart, throat, brow, but sometimes there's also crown. Yeah. Third eye, kind of. Usually when you imagine a deity, they have a white om at their brow, and that indicates enlightened form, because the brain is like the basis of all of our senses, so that's like it indicates enlightened form. The third eye is like more like a tantric symbolism. It's not so much to do with this anatomy lesson. What else in this very esoteric class? Yeah, Ben. It is literally 72,000. Someone has mapped them in great detail, and just like, you know, our nerves, our nervous system, how it branches out like that, and by the time it gets to the fingertips, it's just, you know, it's incredibly sensitive. And when our nervous system is overstimulated, like you get sore fingers and toes, you know, all of that, that's just on the coarse level. So where these channels go, then our mind, the winds go, and so our mind is constantly going outwards, 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 dominated by the senses. So it is 72,000 branches. Yep, that's the number.
Exactly.
Exactly. And so what they are is 72,000 energies that we have to get under control. So
is there a way to herd everyone?
Yeah, that exactly. How to herd everyone, all those 72,000, is don't start at the edges. We start by bringing all the energy into the central channel.
Yeah.
So all of the practices are like that. And this is the reason why, because getting each one individually and then going out to get the next one, it's like, no way, man. No. And so then these drops, like what is so amazing about this is when the great practitioners pass away, they actually manifest some of these drops, these coalescent of body and mind, subtle body and mind, as holy relics.
That's what the pearls are.
That's what those little pearls are. They're like physically manifested drops that they leave, the wisdom relics. No, so as you go through the death process, all of that physical stuff falls away.
Wow.
Yeah. So what you're left with is the very subtle body and mind, and that's going to depend on how you lived your life, what karmic seed ripens, your state of mind at the time of death. Yeah. The little holy relics that you might have heard about or seen. So some are in the shape of pearls, Geshe Lama Khonchog's holy relics. They're often found in the ashes of when the body is being cremated of a great meditation master. And there's these incredible pearls that are left in the ashes. And when the pearls are collected up in this very special way, then if they end up in the house of someone really devoted, they start to multiply. Yeah. So there's several holy relics exhibitions. One's in the Bendigo Great Stupa. We've got some holy relics here on my left. There's also some up at Chenrezig Institute. There's the Maitreya statue touring holy relics. So you can actually see these. They're just extraordinary, unbelievable substances. And when you're there, your mind just goes somewhere else. You really get the blessing. Yeah. Yep, they actually multiply. Yeah, so all of the antipsychotic medication and anti-seizures and all of that can help. They can help get winds that are overstimulated or really weak back subdued and pacified. Because if it's happening on that gross level, you need to start by dealing with it on that gross level, if you at all can.
Yeah.
And then later on do some practices to strengthen the more subtle practices of it. Yeah, so we're lucky we can have help with our Western medicine as well. So that's the end of the psychic anatomy lesson. Now, the path of highest yoga tantra. So we've got meditations similar to, in aspect to death, intermediate state and rebirth. And what we're trying to do is gain control over this process. And we have two stages. We've got generation stage, and we've got completion stage. So generation stage is like the flight simulator. And completion stage is like actually getting in the rocket and taking off. So you want to get really good at the flight simulator, just like our airline pilots. They spend how many hours in that flight simulator, and then they get in the plane, and then they can actually fly the plane. So generation stage takes the three kayas onto the path through meditation similar in process of death, bardo or intermediate state and rebirth. So it's like the rehearsal. It's done in imagination, but it's a correct imagination. So I'll go into this a little bit more in a moment. Then, so generation stage, you can, I think you attain generation stage where you can hold the deity and the entire mandala perfectly in all of its parts for just 1 second. And then you stabilize generation stage when you can hold it for a few hours. That's stabilized. And then you consummate generation stage when it can be for a few weeks, a few years, effortless. So there's stages in the stages. A little bit like, you know, when you look at a Persian carpet, so you might get familiar with this detail and that detail, but it's all one after the other, one after the other. But after a while, when you're really familiar, you can see the whole thing all at once. You close your eyes and there it is, the whole thing all at once. So once you've really accomplished that, then you can start on the completion stage, which is where you actually do it. You through the meditation, you actually gain control of those winds. You bring them into the central channel, You separate all of those knots, and you're able to separate your subtle body and mind from the coarse body and mind at will in the meditation, until you're able to attain the illusory body, the light body of a Buddha, and then arise into the form of the deity, actually arise into the form of the deity. So completion stage is really in detail about how to actually transform body and mind into a Buddha. And how it's done is taking ordinary death, intermediate state and rebirth onto the path, and using that process that's so deep and integral to then attain Dharmakaya, Sambhogakaya and Nirmanakaya. So this again is from Lama Yeshe. For the person who is well prepared, the dying process offers an unequaled opportunity to experience what he or she has always been searching for. The subtle, penetrating and supremely blissful mind of clear light. However, although such a blissful mind arises automatically during the death process, for all of us, most of us are unable to take any advantage of it at all. Our death, like our life, goes by without conscious, clear-minded control. And what could have been the gateway to liberation becomes instead a passage into yet another lifetime of confusion. So that kind of answers your question about, well, what happens if our energies are all disturbed? We just continue the way that we were going. The cure for such uncontrollably recurring confusion is a type of meditation in which we transform our ordinary experiences of death, intermediate state and rebirth into the enlightened experience of a Buddha. We generally think that dying is something negative, but this is just our projection. In fact, dying can be a lot better than the experiences we ordinarily think of as pleasurable, because these ordinary experiences cannot give us tremendous bliss and peace. A beautiful flower can give us something, but not the extraordinary bliss and peace that the death experience can. A boyfriend or girlfriend may be able to give us a certain amount of pleasure or bliss, but cannot solve any of our fundamental problems. But at the time of death, all of our emotional problems and all our anxiety end, as all the conflicting concepts of this and that naturally disappear into space. The way is open to experience extraordinary penetrative insight. What we have to realize, therefore, is that death is not a sudden and terrifying annihilation, but a gradual process during which our mind grows more and more fine and subtle. If we want to practice highest yoga tantra, or even if we merely want to prepare for what we must all eventually encounter, we should become as familiar with this gradual process as we can now, because if we wait until the moment of death itself, it'll be too late. Right. Quick. Yeah. Okay, that's right. So you have that experience of almost drowning, then the peace. So that shows that underneath all of the this and that, you know, is this much more subtle, peaceful layer. And yeah, your subtle body and mind start to separate from your physical one. And then there comes this moment of a choice. Do you keep going or do you come back? And if you come back, it's a bam, back into reality, fight to breathe, like it's a really different thing. But I think that's a really special experience to have, because it doesn't matter how many times people say, oh, you know, it's there. Once you have this experience, it's a knowing. Yeah. So thank you.
You can't unknow it.
These three experiences that we take onto the path. So we've got The ordinary, in times of normally ordinary life, it's called death. But the result that we can actually achieve from this is the Dharmakaya. So the basis, the actual, you know, the foundation for it, we go through the eight stages of the death process. And so there is a whole Discovering Buddhism unit on this, death and rebirth, where you go into nitty-gritty detail, and this is why it's important to know. And so to keep in mind that, you know, our body and mind slowly shut down level by level. The body eventually loses its ability to support the mind. As we go through those eight stages of the death process, then as it gets more and more subtle, then the breathing stops, then there still continues more and more subtle dissolutions where all conceptions disappear. And right at the end, there's the mind of clear light. And that's so subtle that if we're not familiar with it, it's just like you're just driving through a town, you blink and it's gone. It's just at the momentum of everything that's driving us means we often miss it. So even though everything that we're trying to do is have this subtle mind arise with no distractions, when all the distractions fall away, all of that coming in through the senses falls away because those senses have now disintegrated and finished, we miss our big opportunity. What normally happens then, the clear light of death, and then the mind and the body separate, and the body becomes a corpse and the mind arises into the intermediate state. So that's the normal thing. What happens on the path, though, is different. So you meditate on this process of dissolution, and when you get to the clear light, you arrest or you stop ordinary appearances and conceptions, and you rest in that emptiness. You focus on emptiness, and you do whatever analysis that you can in that emptiness. So you become really familiar with it. So you're practicing. And also at the stage of the path, in completion stage, that's when the winds do actually enter the central channel and the clear light does actually dawn. So when that mind becomes manifest in meditation, you can have a very powerful meditation. So if anyone's ever, has anyone here been to one of those float tanks?
Yeah.
Okay. So what's the beauty of the float tank? Why do you go? You didn't like it. Yours was a failure.
I fell asleep and rolled over.
You fell asleep and rolled over and had a near-death experience.
I kept trying to find the surface of the water, but I kept hitting the bottom of the tank.
Oh, that's just horrendous. Okay, different kind of near-death experience altogether. But Ben, you had one. So you're there, you're in the temperature the same as the body, so you lose the edge of your body in the water.
It's very peaceful
because there's no stuff coming in through the senses to distract us, for a while at least, until the brain throws them up because you're bored. That sense of not being distracted, that peace and calm, that's what can happen in the meditation because all of our senses have literally withdrawn. So we have no more distractions, with the added bonus that you're not going to roll over and drown.
Do they close the lid?
I couldn't think of anything worse than to do that. But I think if you're the kind of person that's going to help, it's really worth doing at least once just to get the experience of it.
I would say, I tried to meditate in them. I found it really hard because I didn't have an anchor in my body. My body was
Okay.
I just had my mind. I was like, whoa.
That's because if you try and meditate in them, the anchor isn't your body. The anchor is Dharmakaya, emptiness, bare awareness, not any physical form at all.
I tried to do that, but I was kind of going all over the place.
Unmoored and unanchored. Which kind of shows us that we still need to get really familiar with these meditations. So then on the time of the result, what this is the substantial cause for is the clear light. So the time of the result, what it turns into, is the actual clear light dawns. And in that meditation, you can meditate as long as you can before you get distracted. But actually, the result is the Dharmakaya. So then the second one, the intermediate state, Sambhogakaya. So normally, the time of the basis, our ordinary body and mind, when we die, we leave our old body behind and we arise into the intermediate state. And so what propels us into the intermediate state?
Delusion and karma.
Delusion and karma, that's right. The normal things that drive us, the drivers of the machinery of samsara. So when we arise into the intermediate state, we take the form, normally, in an ordinary life, of our future rebirth. Whatever we're going to be reborn as, we take that form, in a subtle form. Huh? Just whatever. If you're going to be reborn as a human, you take the form as a human.
Okay.
If you're going to be reborn as a cat, you arise in the form of a cat. If you're going to be reborn in a god realm, you arise in the form of a god. So you take the subtle form. This is like an intermediate state. You take that subtle form of what's coming, the future rebirth. So that's why you really want to die at the minimum with a peaceful mind, not an angry mind. Because an angry mind will cause a negative seed to ripen and you'll rise as the form of a crocodile or a fighting dog or something, you know.
Helping.
Yeah, something that perfectly mirrors that state of mind. But at the time of the path, you see, what we're so determined to help sentient beings that we have just really in deep inside our very being aspirational prayer, the momentum of bodhicitta. That's what's driving us, not karma and affliction anymore. Now it's just this determination, I must do it to help sentient beings. This is my one shot. I've got to be able to help sentient beings. So it becomes your instinctual momentum. And so you arise from emptiness into the seed syllable, into the very subtle body of the deity. It's like the most subtle form of the deity, like the DNA of the deity. It's not yet full fruition, but everything there, all the ingredients are there for what you're going to become. So it's like the future form of what you're going to become. It's like the blueprint, that's right. And so depending what deity you're going to become, in what form you're going to become enlightened, it'll be that seed syllable. Yeah. The blueprint. The blueprint from the Dharmakaya blue. Thanks, Kate.
I'll let you pick.
And then the result is it becomes a substantial cause to actually arise into the Sambhogakaya. To actually arise like that. But as we know, this isn't enough to help sentient beings, is it? Who can relate to a seed syllable? Can you have a conversation with a seed syllable? Very difficult. So then there's the impetus to take a form. So that's rebirth. At the time of the basis, we take rebirth under the power of karma and affliction. It just happens, we're just propelled. But at the time of the path, what we're trying to do is arise into a form of the deity. So we're trying to draw the subtle body and mind out from the coarse body and mind. And that's what arises as the deity in place of the old body. It's not that this coarse body arises as a deity. No, no, no. It's the subtle body and mind arising. And so what propels us? The driver, the machinery, it's bodhicitta. So that's why all the previous practices, you know, especially in the sutra path, are so important, because that has to become our fundamental driver, or this isn't going to work. And so then the result, achieve the rainbow body, and you emanate as the Nirmanakaya. And of course, once you achieve the rainbow body of one form, one Buddha, then it's all Buddhas. So the reason there's one Buddha that you focus on is because that's one, the one that you might have the closest karmic connection with and the most likelihood to be drawn to, that that's the one that you'll become enlightened with. But once you're enlightened, then it's all Buddhas. It's like the gateway. Yes. So what questions do you have about this, the three kayas into the three Buddha bodies? Yeah. As far as I know, it's only Tibetan Buddhism that has these tantric practices being practiced now. There are tantric deities that I've seen, like in the Japanese Buddhism. But I don't know if they have these practices in detail, or if they're like bodhisattvas arising like that, so it's more the sutra vehicle. I'm not sure. Yeah. But I am under the impression that it's really only in the Tibetan tradition that these practices are living practices. Well, it's the seed. So think of it as the seed. So the seed has everything contained within it, but it isn't fully manifest yet. Yeah. So of course, but the elements also transform into the energy of the five Buddha families, but it's that in itself is an extraordinary process, and I have a little story about that. So it's not necessarily so much to do with the seed syllable as such.
Quarter past.
Oh, okay. And Chris, you had a question?
No,
I'm just throwing it. Oh, you sure? You're not just hiding behind Bev. So then, if your mind isn't blown enough already, well, now here we go, completion stage. So in completion stage, you actually transform the ordinary body and mind into an enlightened being. I can't say that enough. It's like we kind of hear it and we go, oh, yeah, yada, yada, yada. Maybe it goes abracadabra, poof, into smoke or something, who knows. But there is a whole process. And in your notes, some of you might have this one, the stages of the paths of mantra, and it's quite a detailed process in the, it's in the Discovering Buddhism notes for this unit. And so this one goes into detail, and you start from reading from the bottom and go upwards. So from the bottom, the very lowest line has the preliminaries. And then slowly, this is like how I was telling you about, this is like the contents page. This is everything that happens. But actually how to do it is the whole sadhana. So what we start with, I might just read something from Lama Yeshe first. So Lama Yeshe says, the generation stage practice of the three kayas is in fact only a rehearsal for the more advanced completion stage practices that actually transform our ordinary body and mind into the completely transcendent body and mind of an enlightened being. But the generation stage preparation is absolutely necessary. It's only through loosening the concrete concepts that we have about ourselves, by generating the clear appearance of the deity out of the space of emptiness and cultivating strong divine pride that we are the actual deity. So we talked about those practices last week, that we actually create the room needed for the transformation to take place. Once we are skilled enough to engage in the completion stage practices, such as generating the tummo fire, the inner heat at our navel, or bringing the winds into the central channel, we will be able to bring all of our energy winds into the central channel and cause them to dissolve into it completely, just as they do at death. As a result, the clear light wisdom of our fundamental mind will actually dawn. And eventually we'll be able to manifest the rainbow-like illusory body, which can leave and return to our old physical body at will. These things actually happen. They're not mere visualizations anymore, as they were during the generation stage. The precious Kundalini energy dormant within us is actually aroused. We attain the simultaneously born great blissful wisdom, and we overcome the limitations of our ordinary physical form. I have a story about that in a moment too. So first we have, just in a nutshell, very, very simplifies, we have single-pointed concentration. And so that's where we visualize the deity and the mandala, you know, perfectly. I mean, at the moment, we can have single-pointed concentration on people who've harmed us, on how we want to take revenge, all of this, yeah, no problem. Because that's driven by, you know, afflictive minds that have this grasp on us. But if we're driven by bodhicitta, then we can attain this single-pointed concentration. So then we have what's called Vajra recitation, which are recitation practices that halt our coarse conceptions and winds by bringing our focus into the central channel. And these winds enter. So first they enter the central channel, then they might go back out again, so we keep meditating. Then they enter and they might go back out again. Then we manage to make them enter and then we can hold them there. They abide there for a while. And then there's, and see you later. So, and then after a while, they not only abide, but they dissolve there into the heart. So when that happens, that actually causes the clear light to dawn in the meditation. And then you continue these meditations until then you can arise into what's called the impure illusory body. So it's like a, it's not quite there yet. We're still practicing. More and more subtle focus. And then into what's called the pure illusory body. Again and again and again, getting more and more subtle. Meditating on emptiness, arising into the illusory body, meditating on emptiness, and so on until actually what's called the path of no more learning, enlightenment dawns. So the union of illusory body and clear light mind. When one attains enlightenment, body and mind become inseparable of one nature, just as in the intermediate state. But with the union of illusory body and clear light mind, the body is made of light, is pure of nature, and one has purified all the afflictions. Yeah, that's right. Sometimes death can be quite fast. And so it just means you go through that process extremely quickly. So the benefit of that can be you can turn it around because it's happened so fast you haven't had a chance to get upset. And so if you've been doing these practices, then you would be arising as the deity. Generally, we want to, I mean, the best option is to be able to do this in meditation without having to die. We do this in our life. We go into retreat and we do it in meditation. And so for that, then it just takes a few years. If you're dedicated, it can take a few years. It can happen. But if we don't have that opportunity, then plan B, we are all going to die. This is all going to happen to us. So then we can take that opportunity and at least not waste that. So we don't have to have the concentration and the dedication and the little meditation box set up or anything. It's all going to happen anyway. So we may as well be prepared. Give what?
It's your last shot
at it, that's right. But it can happen. It's a really good plan B. So, I mean, that's what happened with my mother, Inta. She only met the Dharma when she was about 45, maybe met Tibetan Buddhism when she was 50, maybe had her first Vajrayogini initiation when she was maybe 55, and she died at 71. And so, you know, the Lama said she had a very good death. She was in the clear light meditation for about 2.5 days after the breath had stopped and before the consciousness left the body. And then I'm pretty sure she did a detour to the Pure Lands for a bit before coming back and being reborn. So that's a lady, you know, that started this centre, that had bright hair and cat glasses and outrageous clothes and loved SBS movies and, you know, just like us, it can happen.
She wasn't a monk.
She wasn't a monk or a nun, and she wasn't like super pure, holy or whatever. She was just really dedicated. And so a couple of years before she died, because she died of cancer, you know, Lama Zopa Rinpoche said, time to start doing completion stage practices now. So he said, you know, you've been doing generation stage practices for all this time, now start doing completion so that she's ready, because he could see, you know, death was coming. But there's other ways that this can happen too. Here's the story. So this is the ultimate fruition of this particular practice in Dzogchen, the attainment of the rainbow body, a body of pure energy. So when the practitioner is about, the realized practitioner is about to die, his or her physical body gradually dissolves into light. In such cases, the physical body vanishes, shrinking in size, until only the hair and nails remain as indicators of the process that has occurred. Each element of the body, earth, water, fire, air, space, dissolves into the corresponding energy from which it originally arose. The attainment of the rainbow body that the person has moved, the attainment of the rainbow body means that the person has moved from the physical or Nirmanakaya realm of existence to the Sambhogakaya, in which there is the appearance of energy, light and form, but no physical matter. Having attained this, one no longer undergoes the process of death and rebirth. This attainment of the rainbow body is typically accompanied by strange phenomena of lights and rainbows, marking the non-physical state into which the practitioner is moving. So I also remember when Inta was dying, and a friend of mine was, like, she was still in the kind of death meditation. A friend of mine was driving us back to the house. So we're going up the hill to up Anagra Road, up the hill to where the centre was, and there was this incredible double rainbow right over the house. And I'm going, wow, look at that. And the driver's like, yeah, bloody drivers. And they didn't even see it. They were probably concentrating on driving. But there it was, this double rainbow in the middle of the day. No clouds, no nothing. Incredible. So here's a story from contemporary times. So this person took rainbow body in the cowshed of one of my guru's mother's household. The event was witnessed by several people. And Jamgong Khontral's brother, a very tall and handsome man, was present at the time, and it happened like this. An elderly nun came through their village on pilgrimage. When she saw the wealthy household, she asked for a place where she could make a retreat. They offered her one of their vacant cow sheds. She told them, I want to use it for a week to make a strict retreat. I want the door sealed up. Please pile stones against the door because I don't want any disturbance. Since the household was used to sponsoring practitioners, they agreed and no one thought twice about it. They said, sure, have it your way. They didn't know who was going to look after her or bring her food. They just thought she'd already made arrangements. After 3 days, some strange phenomena began to occur. Scintillating, swirling light rays of different colours were seeping out of the holes and cracks of the cowshed stone wall. Light was shining out from under the room, while outside the shed, spheres of light moved rapidly about. The people of the house wondered, what's going on in there? Who's looking after the old woman? Who's bringing her food? They asked the servants. The servants thought someone else was giving her food, but no one actually was. They decided she must have been cooking for herself. But Jamgon Kulchul's brother asked, is there any place to cook inside? And the servant said, no, there's no fireplace or anything. So they wondered, what's she eating? Does she have any water? What are all those lights about? Finally, they decided to take a look. They removed the pile of stones and pried open the door. They saw that the body of the nun had fallen to pieces. Her hands were lying in one place and her feet were lying on another. Her limbs were no longer connected to the body, but lay scattered in pieces. And from the ends of the bones, swirls of rainbow light were coiling out as the body continued to fall apart. The observers asked each other, what's this? It looks like she's dead. And one person had the presence of mind to say, let's just leave her alone. It looks like something unusual is happening here. She asked for 7 days of solitude, so let's just do what she asked. And saying that, they sealed up the shed again. Then when they returned after the 7th day and opened the shed, the rainbow lights had vanished. Not a drop of blood, nor flesh, nor bones could be found anywhere. Only the nails from the fingers and toes remained lying there very neatly, along with a hank of hair. So you might think, well, no way. But if you just look at this little picture of a rocket ship, you know, going to the moon up until just, you know, a generation ago was no way, wasn't it? Getting on a plane, can you imagine that heavy thing going up was just no way.
Some people still think it's
not. So that's right. Some people still think we never got to the moon, that's right. So before I go on, anything at all to mention or ask or yeah, Tom. We need to learn from Obi-Wan Kenobi. Well, you can see where they got their material from. And in fact, I went to see the second Star Wars with a bunch of Tibetans, and they just laughed and laughed and laughed because the Ewoks all spoke Tibetan.
Yeah. They speak Tibetan.
They speak Tibetan. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What? What are they saying?
I don't know, but the Tibetans kept mum about that. So, how is this done exactly? You know, we're using the desire, or more specifically, the energy of desire, of the energy of blissful, the blissful experiences, to fuel the experience of wisdom. So, it literally becomes rocket fuel. We've got everything in our present body-mind complex to become a Buddha. How is it done exactly? Well, I just thought I'd mention two things. One, follow the instructions. Don't be like Beaker in the chemical lab, because, you know, we know about chemical labs. Whether you understand how a chemical reaction works or not, it is going to work. It doesn't require belief. It doesn't require understanding. If you put X and Y together, you're going to get the result every time. So this is really precision practice like this. You don't have to make anything up. It's worth your while following the instructions. They're all found in the Sadhana. They're all found in the oral instructions from the guru after the initiation. So initiation isn't just the ceremony. It's everything that is shared afterwards. That's part of it. So don't be like Beaker and blow yourself up. So the Sadhana practice, the commentaries, the Guru's oral advice, they're the instructions. And of course, you've got to have the appropriate initiation. That's like having your due diligence, all the safety factors there. And so my last little reading for the night, The instruction manual, I found this great thing from Norman Doidge, The Brain That Changes Itself, that kind of gives us an idea too of how just by doing the meditation has an effect on us. So Here's what Norman Doidge says. In an experiment that is as hard to believe as it is simple, Doctors Yu and Cole showed that imagining one is using one's muscles actually strengthens them. So the study looked at two groups, one that did a physical exercise and one that imagined doing exercise. And both groups exercised a finger muscle Monday through Friday for 4 weeks. Not that long. The physical group did trials of 15 maximal contractions with a 20-second rest between each. So again, that's not that long. And the mental group merely imagined doing 15 maximal contractions with a 20-second rest between each, while also imagining a voice shouting at them, harder, harder, harder. So you got the whole cheer squad there. So at the end of the study, 4 weeks, the subjects who'd done the physical exercise increased their muscular strength by 30%, as one might expect. Those who only imagined doing the exercise for the same period increased their muscle strength by 22%. The explanation lies in the motor neurons of the brain that program movements. During these imaginary contractions, the neurons responsible for stringing together sequences of instructions for movements are activated and strengthened, resulting in increased strength when the muscles are actually contracted. So I found a real parallel here between generation stage and completion stage. You do all of this practice, you strengthen all of those imaginary muscles so that when the actual thing happens, you do it. It actually happens. I mean, the other thing is, hey, you can get fit just by imagining, there's something in there, isn't it? You've got to do it regularly. And of course, what it does is it builds up the strength of everything surrounding the activity, which is as much as what the activity is. So then you go to do the activity, you're already really good at it. So this is what can happen in, you know, the death process for us. World-class gymnasts, runners, yeah, everyone, they real elite athletes, they practice in their mind and they actually go through step by step as if it were true, like a flight simulator. That's right, though, all of those things. So when they go to do it, they do it exactly. I think there was an athlete that actually broke her foot. And so she practiced like that in her mind until her foot was better, how to run the race, every minuscule tiny bit of each step.
Yes, she didn't
stop training. So she didn't stop training, that's right, just physically. And so then when she actually ran the race, she did it exactly as she imagined. Yeah, every single detail becomes a support of it. Yeah, absolutely. So this kind of thing where we underestimate the power of imagination because it actually has this effect on us. Yeah, it's something we can really use. Just because you imagine it doesn't mean it's not real. That's correct. And so when we're imagining here, they actually accord to something that is possible to achieve, which is completely different from our ordinary samsaric life, which doesn't match at all. We can't achieve any of those things that we're striving for in our samsaric life. So that's that one. The other thing is taking a consort. Now, we've all heard about this. You know, at some stage in completion stage practices.
There's the old man
laughing. Yeah,
this is the Californian tantra.
This is the Californian tantra that, yes, can be very much misconstrued. So how do you know when you're ready to take a consort? When you can make the fruit fall down from the tree and go back up again.
His Holiness said that, right?
That's right, that's what His Holiness said. So Eddie said, most memorably, first you have to learn to ride the horse, then you can put the ballerina on top. So you don't learn to ride a horse by putting a ballerina on top. And I mean, this is the thing that everybody thinks somehow high circuit tantra is all about sex. No way. So to be you only take a consort when you've reached completion stage, and it doesn't have to be a physical consort. So if you're a monk or a nun, you can't break your vows. There's not like some special double standard happening here. You either disrobe, give your vows back and leave the monastery, and then take a consort just once. It's just a once only thing. Or in meditation, you can have what's called a wisdom consort. So you don't need a physical consort, which is what Lama Tsongkhapa did. That's right, to demonstrate, to kind of get everybody in line in the monastery. So you need to take a consort so that you have just this one example of bliss, and then you cause the clear light to dawn. So it's like a, you know, it's like you need to have the example. So there's a huge amount of misunderstanding about this. Wisdom consort. Oh yes, sorry, bad spelling.
Action. No, I'm saying that what it's actually called.
Action consort or wisdom consort. That's right. Yeah, that's the terminology. Yeah. So this is what Lama Yeshe says about this, about the blessings of the Dharkas and the Dakinis. So when the completion stage practices have been mastered and we've gained control over our subtle energy winds, there will come a time when the Dharkas and Dakinis will come. What are the Dharkas and Dakinis? Simply speaking, they are males and females who possess advanced experiences of tantric transformation and control, and are therefore able to increase the blissful wisdom of a highly qualified practitioner. There's a certain point in the mastery of the completion stage when physically embracing such a consort is necessary for bringing all the pervading energy winds into the central channel, a prerequisite for opening the heart center completely and experiencing the profoundest level of clear light. The subject of practice with a consort is open to great misinterpretation, especially by people who've made only superficial contact with Buddhist Tantra. Many Westerners, for instance, because they've seen Tibetan paintings and statues showing deities in embrace, have the mistaken notion that Tibetan Buddhism is mainly concerned with sexual contact between men and women. But as was pointed out earlier, what this art is actually representing is the experience of total unity, of method and wisdom, bliss and emptiness, characteristic of the fully enlightened state. But now, with the mention of completion stage practices, there's further opportunity for confusion to arise. Therefore, it should be emphasized that until we've gained mastery over our subtle body and have embraced the blissful kundalini energy dormant within, we are not at all qualified to embrace an external consort. I remember one year, this lovely couple, that they coming to Lungri Tungpa Centre, and then they got together at Lungri Tungpa Centre, and then they were really shy, and they asked, oh, so does that mean, you know, we can make all having sex like part of the path? I'm like, I'm so sorry to tell you. Not at all. Unless you've mastered completion stage practices, it ain't going to happen. But, you know, enjoy each other and be nice to each other, and maybe that'll mean that you're relaxed and happy enough to actually continue on the path. So that's one side of things. But the other side of things also is the blessings of the Dharkas and Dakinis isn't just something that happens later on. It also happens in when you go on pilgrimage, when you go to holy sites. Those holy sites have a resonance that blesses all the drops and chakras in your body. So they kind of get awakened just by the power of place, going to those places. And power places, like if anyone's been to Uluru, you've experienced that. You know, there's a blessing that happens by going to a power place like that. There's also the blessings of the Dharkas and the Dakinis from the tunes that come from the Dakinis. So those exquisite tunes in Guru Puja, you know, that take you to a beyond conceptual state. They're tunes that come from the Dakinis themselves and bless our mind. So we have an experience and a blessing of this already. All right, so Highest Yoga Tantra, highly specialized guidebook, better than any treasure map in history. Our samsaric body can become the basis of nirvana. And through these highly specialized, detailed meditations, we can actually arise into the rainbow body of a Buddha. And our coarse body will just dissolve back into the elements from which it came. So if you say, I'm not ready for Highest Yoga Tantra, just change the framing of that and say, I'm working towards Highest Yoga Tantra. It's really important to reframe that. And remember, there's the most amazing plan B. We can take our own death, intermediate state, and rebirth onto the path and arise as a Buddha then. That's a really extraordinary plan B. Readings in the book, pages 5 to 7, the Highest Yoga Tantra section, and there's also words of advice from Geshe Tenfold, which is a separate PDF page. And next week we're going to look at how to set up a retreat and the keys to success in Tantra. We made it. Let's dedicate. For those of you newly joining us tonight, this was called the very, very deep dive in. And so let's dedicate that oneself and others appear as the deity. Your mind is inseparable from non-dual wisdom and every experience is one of great bliss. Kia ora te nyo tu ta la. Swift recognition.